The sin of worshiping the property, the things, the facilities that God gives to the church to use, that's a sin that nips at the heels of the church its entire life. And when he returned to Capernaum after some days, it was reported that he was at home. And many were gathered together so that there was no more room, not even at the door. And he was preaching the word to them, and they came bringing to him a paralytic carried by four men. And when they could not get near him because of the crowd, they removed the roof above him. And when they had made an opening, they let down the bed on which the paralytic lay. And when Jesus saw their faith, he said to the paralytic, "Son, your sins are forgiven." Now some of the scribes were sitting there questioning in their hearts, "Why does this man speak like this? He's blaspheming. Who can forgive sins but God alone?" And immediately Jesus, perceiving in his spirit that they thus questioned him within themselves, said to them, "Why do you question these things in your hearts? Which is easier to say to the paralytic, 'Your sins are forgiven,' or to say, 'Rise, take up your bed and walk'? But that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins." He said to the paralytic, "I say to you, rise, pick up your bed, and go home." And he rose and immediately picked up his bed and went out before them all, so that they were all amazed and glorified God, saying, "We never saw anything like this." So as we begin chapter 2, we are going to notice a change in focus. Jesus has experienced opposition up to this point. He's, of course, experienced opposition from the demonic in the wilderness. Again, opposition from the demonic in the synagogue. He's also experienced opposition from the crowds. The crowds who are believing and they're enthusiastic and excited about Jesus, but nonetheless, they misunderstand. And so their enthusiastic misunderstanding becomes an obstacle for Jesus, and he must leave because his message cannot get through all of their enthusiasm for his healings. He also has experienced opposition from the disciples. The disciples who themselves, of course, believe upon Jesus, but they themselves are misunderstanding of him as well. The disciples are not Jesus' helpers. Jesus didn't assemble around him 12 helpers to help him establish his kingdom. The disciples themselves don't understand. The disciples themselves need to be taught. They need to be rebuked, and they need to be corrected, and they need to be shown what Messiah is here for. So he's experiencing opposition from the crowds, from the disciples, even though they're enthusiastic and believing. He's also experienced opposition from the demonic. But beginning from chapter 2, Jesus will now experience opposition from the unbelieving people. And this is a theme that will be continued from this point to the end of the gospel. We see it here in chapter 2 with these scribes and Pharisees who are questioning in their hearts, saying, "Who is this person to be doing this?" But let's just take a glance through the rest of the chapter. Let me just show you how this theme is going to continue and even develop. Look down at verse 16. From verse 16, "And the scribes of the Pharisees, when they saw that he was eating with the sinners and tax collectors, said to his disciples, 'Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners?'" Or look down at verse 18. "Now John's disciples and the Pharisees were fasting, and people came and said to him, 'Why do John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees fast, but your disciples don't fast?'" Or look down at verse 24. You see how it just continues on. "And the Pharisees were saying to him, 'Look, why are they doing what is not lawful for the Sabbath?'" And then it all culminates in chapter 3, verse 6. "The Pharisees went out and immediately held counsel with the Herodians against him on how to destroy him or to kill him." So these unbelieving religious leaders, in their unbelief, are opposing Jesus at every turn. "Why are you doing this? Why aren't your disciples fasting? Why are you saying this? Why are you picking this grain? Why are you doing all this?" And then all of this is going to culminate when they finally decide, you know, we cannot oppose his teaching. We cannot contradict his teaching. We cannot overcome him in this way. And so this man needs to be destroyed. And so I kind of think of it like this. This is, for me, this is helpful as I read through the Gospel of Mark. And as we go through Mark together, this is helpful for me to kind of understand how Mark is leading us along. Because if we look to chapter 15, in chapter 15, we're going to see a cross. And on this cross, of course, hangs the Messiah. And the Messiah is put on the cross in the early morning hours. And so you know how as the sun comes up over the horizon in the early morning hours, something tall casts a long shadow. And the cross is going to cast a long shadow all the way across chapter 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, all the way to chapter 2. And so what we are beginning to see is the edges, the beginning of that shadow, which is the cross, the shadow of the cross, because all of this is God's plan. It is God's plan to crush his son. It is God's will that he crush his son. However, God will not reach down from heaven with a spiritual hand and crush his son in a physical way like that. Instead, he will use human agents to do that. And the humans that he will use will be the religious leaders. God will not use the demonic to crush his son. God will not use the disciples in their confusion, or he won't use the crowds in their confusion. He will use the religious leaders to bring about what he desires, which is the sacrificial death of his son in chapter 15. And so we begin to see that theme now that we trace through. Mark is going to, as you probably know, Mark is going to spend about a third of his gospel on the last week of Jesus's life, because Mark is in sort of a hurry to get us there. And he wants us to see already, these are the seeds. This is what's being planted. This is what's growing. This opposition to Jesus on the part of the religious leaders, this will be what culminates in what we're going to see in chapter 15 with our Messiah hanging from the cross. And so we begin here from chapter 2 and verse 1. And we realize here in chapter 2, verse 1, we're told that Jesus returns here to Capernaum. We're told when he returned to Capernaum after some days. We don't know how many of those some days were. But Jesus had to leave Capernaum, of course, because of that night of healing some time back. The excitement was so great, he had to leave that because his message couldn't get through all the fog of the excitement. So he leaves for some time. And after some days, he now comes back to Capernaum, because the crowds apparently have now dissipated enough that Jesus feels that he can return. So as he comes here, we're also going to see here, let me just point this out to you as well as we're getting started. Here we come across the crowds which have kept Jesus away. Now Jesus returns and we're going to have to deal with the crowds in the house itself. But let's just see, if you look with me over to chapter 3 and verse 7. Chapter 3 and verse 7, we read these words. Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the sea, and a great crowd followed from Galilee and Judea. And then look at verse 9. And he told his disciples to have a boat ready for him because of the crowd, lest they crush him. For he had healed many, so that all who had diseases pressed around him to touch him. So here the crowds have grown so great and so bold, so to speak, that Jesus even fears for being crushed. He said, give me a boat before they crush me. And then look down with me at chapter 3 and verse 20. Then he went home and the crowd gathered again so that they could not even eat. So the crowds are crowding around Jesus to such a degree, as we're going to see in the story today, that literally the one that Jesus wants to come to him has difficulty getting to him. But we're going to see over and over again that the crowd is not something that Mark portrays to us as being on Jesus' side. Jesus is not happy about this popularity. Jesus' popularity is not helping his mission. It's inhibiting his mission because the crowds are so enthusiastic about the wrong things. And so Mark again and again is going to portray the crowds as something that Jesus needs to overcome, as in our story today. So from verse 1, when he returned to Capernaum after some days, it was reported that he was at home. So whose home was he at? Perhaps he was at Peter's home, though I think the text is going to lend that to be unlikely for us. We'll see a little bit later on that, of course, the whole text is going to center around the need to make an opening in the roof. And we talked a few Sundays back about Peter's home there in Capernaum and how it had that big courtyard in the middle. You remember that? And so it seems as though if Jesus was at Peter's house and such a crowd was there, it would seem like that Jesus would be in the courtyard and there wouldn't be the need to open the roof. So perhaps he's not at Peter's house. Perhaps he's at James and John's house, or perhaps he's at another disciple's house. We're not told, and it doesn't matter. We're just told that he's here at some home, some place that he's calling home away from home. He's left Nazareth now, and so this is a place that he's residing at, most likely belongs to someone else, because Jesus will tell us elsewhere that foxes have holes and dens and everything, but the Son of Man doesn't have a place to lay his head. So he's here. It's reported. The news gets out that he's here at home. Verse 2. And many were gathered together, so many, in fact, that there was no more room, not even at the door. And he was preaching the word to them. So here we see the crowd is gathered. There's so many people in this house, in this room, that literally even the doorway is packed tight. No one can come in and out, and so many people inside. And what Jesus is doing inside is he is preaching the word. So by this point in Mark's gospel, you yourselves can teach what needs to be taught because you've seen it enough times. Jesus' main priority is to preach the word. We've seen it over and over already. This was his main emphasis. This was his main focus. His main focus was not the miracles or the healings. His main emphasis was on the teaching, on the preaching. So he's here inside this room and he's preaching the word to them. And there's so many gathered together that literally there's no place to move, no place to get in and out. The doors are packed shut. The fire marshal would have had a heyday with this. So the houses here in Capernaum, let's just kind of understand a little bit about what this might have looked like. The houses here in Capernaum, archaeologists tell us that they were mostly made from basalt stone, like a dark black gray sort of stone without mortar. So the inside, being made from dark stones, would have been very dark. Maybe a window, or at least an opening or two, maybe a doorway. Probably very little artificial light, maybe a few oil lamps burning, but it would have been very dark inside and probably rather small. The roof of these houses, we're told, were made from wooden beams that would have thatch put over across the beams. And then on top of the thatch, they would put this thick layer of clay and they'd pack the clay down tight and firm. So we'll see just a little bit about how that's going to be removed in order to get access in. But inside this dwelling, inside this home, it would have been very, very close quarters, very tightly cramped in here. So Jesus wouldn't be, as I'm doing now, standing apart from those whom he would be right there with them. They would be within arm's reach. They could reach over and touch his elbow and his arm. He would be right here in front of them, speaking face to face with them. Now, let's just think for a little bit about who would have been in the room? Because I think the natural assumption is to think that the room would be filled with Capernaums, whatever, people from Capernaum, whatever they would be called, Capernaums. It would be filled with people who were from Capernaum, who had heard of Jesus' teaching. Maybe they were there in the synagogue when he did that teaching in the synagogue some weeks back. And it made such an impression upon him. They heard that he's back, and so they flocked to him now. Maybe people that were there for the healing, the night of healing, maybe others whom Jesus has healed at other times, others who have heard about this man, his teaching, and they're interested. They want to hear this man. They want to see this man. And so we would naturally assume that the room would be filled with people who are anxious to hear Jesus. However, Luke, in his account in chapter 5, gives us an important detail that's very helpful for us. Chapter 5, verse 17 from Luke's gospel. On one of those days, as he was teaching, Pharisees, and this is the same day that Luke is recording for us, Pharisees and teachers of the law were sitting there who had come from every village of Galilee and Judea and from Jerusalem. Now that changes the makeup of the room quite a bit. Because Luke tells us in this occasion, there were religious leaders and Pharisees from every village of Galilee. Now, Mark likes hyperbole. He likes literary hyperbole. So he doesn't literally mean every single village in Galilee. There was over 1,000 villages in Galilee. And even one Pharisee from each village would have meant thousands of Pharisees there. And there weren't even that many Pharisees. There's only 6,000 or so Pharisees. So he doesn't mean every single village. But his point is, there were so many. The villages of Galilee were so well represented by the religious leadership that it's as though they were there from every single village. But not only from the villages of Galilee, we're told that they are here from Jerusalem, and even not just Jerusalem, but all of Judea. So Jerusalem is about 90 miles from Capernaum. So there are religious leaders here from Jerusalem and even from all of Judea. So 100 or more miles away, maybe up to 150 miles, people have come, religious leaders have come to see and hear this man Jesus. So let's not make light of this. This, in our day of easy communication and fast travel, let's not make light of this. For religious leaders from Jerusalem, to drop what they're doing and travel 100 miles to hear some upstart preacher means that the waves Jesus have made are tidal. The impact that Jesus has made, the word that has gotten around, probably largely from the leper who disobeyed, but the word that's got around has rocked Israel. And it's created such a mass interest in Jesus and his teachings that there are religious leaders, Pharisees, from as far away as Jerusalem and further, who have traveled to Capernaum just to hear this uneducated country preacher. So they are here, as we're going to see in the story. We all know how the story plays out. We just read it a few moments ago. They're not here because they want to be followers of Jesus. They are here because they are disbelieving, and they are here in order to gather evidence against this man. That's the extent of what's happening now in Israel. And so the popularity of this man, Jesus, has already hit record high. And that's a popularity that's mixed between those who are enthusiastic about Jesus and those who we're going to read in chapter 3 are making plans to kill him. So the room would have been packed full of people, a mix of Pharisees from as far away as Jerusalem, wearing their fine robes and their fine headdresses, and the common people of Capernaum and the surrounding villages, who are there, working class sort of people who've been working with their hands even that very day probably. And they're here to hear this message of life, this message of salvation. And they're sitting probably side by side almost with these Pharisees in their long flowing robes. Now, we know that elsewhere Jesus tells us about how the Pharisees like to arrange their seating arrangements. From Mark chapter 12, verse 36, verse 37, Jesus says, you like the best seats of the house, of the synagogue. You always, speaking to the Pharisees, you always claim the best seats. When you go to the feasts, you always claim the best seats of the feast. So we have no reason to believe that here, as they're here to hear Jesus, their seating arrangements would have been any different. So probably these Pharisees have the best seats in this tiny little house. So you can imagine, here's Jesus teaching, and around him would have been Pharisees with their long, flowing, bright, colorful robes, with their long tassels. And all around them are working class people, people who work the land, people who work with animals and livestock. And they're here to hear the message of life. And here's these Pharisees here to pick apart everything that Jesus is going to say. That gives us a little bit of a insight, perhaps, into the context, if you will. The mood in the room as Jesus is teaching here. So there's no more room, not even at the door. And he was preaching the word to them. Verse 3. And they came, bringing to him a paralytic carried by 4 men. And as they came, bringing this paralytic carried by 4 men, we're not told how they carried him. Maybe it was a type of a litter with poles, but it's probably more like the bed. You may be familiar with sort of like a rollout mat that they would call a bed. Something similar to maybe what you would roll out and sleep on if you're going to go camping or something like that. Something like that is probably how they're carrying him. And they probably 2 of them have the feet part and 2 of them have the head part. So you can imagine these friends carrying this paralytic through the streets of Capernaum to get to Jesus on this maybe a little bit more than a blanket. And you can imagine the bustling streets of Capernaum, how everybody's trying to get here to see Jesus and just dragging him along. Maybe he's scraping along the ground as they're dragging him. His head's banging against the corners as they turn around corners. People's legs are kicking on his head and everything. And he gets here to the place where Jesus is because they just have to get him to see Jesus. The dedication, the devotion of these 4 friends is remarkable. They just have to get him to Jesus. And we're going to see the length that they go to in just a few minutes of what they go to get their friend to Jesus. What a remarkable friendship. We know nothing about the paralytic. We know nothing about his friends other than what we're told in the story here. But what a remarkable friendship for a man to have 4 people who care that much about him to go to this length to get him to Jesus. Most of us would probably consider ourselves fortunate to have 1 person in our life that would have a friendship such as that. This man had 4. And they're going to great lengths to get him to Jesus. So they came bringing him bringing to him a paralytic carried by four men. Verse 4, and when they could not get near him because of the crowd, so they're trying to squeeze in through the door. There's no way to get in. There's just too many people. And the paralytic, he's been drugged and handed around, and his friends here, he's hearing them talk and tell each other how we can't get in there. What can we do? Go around the back. Maybe we can go through a window. But they can't get him to Jesus because there's just too many people. Verse 4, and when they could not get near him because of the crowd, see how the crowd is an obstacle. Because of the crowd, they removed the roof above him. So they go up to the roof. Houses in Capernaum were almost exclusively one-story houses. And we already mentioned the thatched roofs, which are common there. Now, this thatched roof is a little bit, as we said earlier, it's a little bit different from just a normal thatched roof when you think of like what you see in National Geographic magazines of a thatched kind of roof. It's a thatch that would have been covered with this hard, packed layer of clay. Clay that would be packed tightly and spread on top of the thatch. And they even had, we're told, rollers that they would sort of roll it out flat. So houses in this time, in the first century, were often houses that they would use the roof as an additional room. Think about in Acts when Peter's on the roof and he's praying on the roof. People would use the roof as sort of an extra room. So it had this hard-packed clay on the top, maybe some stairs on the outside to lead up. So here come the men, they've dragged him all over Capernaum. Couldn't get him inside. Now they drag him up the steps. Maybe his head's banging on the steps as they take him up because they just got to get him to Jesus. And they don't exactly have this rolling stretcher to carry him home. They're getting him there the best way they can. And they get him up onto the roof and they're not going to make this hole to lower him down. Now, as they come to the roof here, verse 4 again, they removed the roof above him. Literally, they unroofed the roof. And when they had made an opening, Mark literally says they dug an opening. So imagine they don't have a saw or anything like that. They just have maybe their hands, maybe some sort of hand tool, and they're just digging a hole through the hard-packed clay and through the thatch. When they made an opening, they let down the bed on which the paralytic lay. So again, we don't know exactly what the bed was like. If it was more like a litter, I think it's more like, again, just a blanket in which they're holding both ends of the blanket. And they let him down, and Mark tells us specifically they let him down with the bed. So as I thought about this, I tried to think, well, what sort of a hole would they make? How big would this hole have been? Maybe just the minimal 18-inch or 24-inch diameter hole to lower him down feet first with maybe a rope under his armpits, kind of like they brought Jeremiah out of the miry pit, you know, maybe lowered him down that way. And I think that the text precludes that because the text tells us that he's lowered down with the bed. So I think the hole was probably bigger than just big enough to put someone down feet first, big enough for him to at least be folded over in half in the bed and lower down maybe a rope on both ends of the blanket of the bed and lower him down in that way. So it would have been a fairly sizable hole. So what would have taken place as they started to make this hole? Because it would have taken a few minutes at least, I think, to make this hole. So they go up on the roof here and they somehow calculate where it is they should make the hole. Maybe they can hear Jesus through the roof and they can kind of tell where he is because they want to make the hole near him. Or maybe they got a glimpse through the window at where Jesus was in the room and they sort of have an idea of where to make the hole. So they go up there and they start making this hole. So now you're inside the room. And you start to hear this noise on the roof, this banging, scraping on the roof. You ever been listening to a speaker and then a distraction starts to come along and it keeps going and keeps going. And then everybody in the room, you're sort of having this all, you're having the same collective thought. And that thought is, I wonder when the speaker is going to stop and acknowledge the noise that's going on. I think that was what was going on. Everybody's wondering, when's Jesus going to stop? Because everybody hears it and it's getting louder. And then sunlight bursts through. They made a hole. And as that hole was made, surely there would have been clay and bits of thatch and limbs and branches that fell. Some of them probably fell on Jesus. Some probably fell on the Pharisees, making them even more indignant than they already were. Now they've got clay and twigs and things from this man's house on their nice robes. But then as this sunlight bursts through, now they can hear the men on the roof talking. And the hole gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And all this takes several minutes to take place. What was said during all this? Sir, Jesus had to stop at some point. You know, I think most people, like you are right now listening to a preacher, I think most of the time we overestimate how easily a speaker is distracted. People all the time will tell me, you know, sorry to distract you with coughing or had to get up or whatever. And I think most speakers like myself are not as easily distracted as people think they are. However, I've never had somebody make a hole in the roof and lower somebody down while I was speaking. I think if that happened, I would be distracted. And I think even the Son of God, now he has to stop and acknowledge what's taking place. So what would have been said? I don't know if Jesus was the type of person that cracked jokes, but this was, maybe he cracked a joke. And maybe this was a good opportunity to just sort of break the ice or say something light as this hole is being made in the roof. Or maybe the owner of the house is there and he's quite upset. What are you people doing? The Pharisees are grumbling to themselves. What kind of haystack town have we come to? But all this takes place over a number of minutes, and here comes down the man from the roof. Now, it's at this point I want to just pause and take something that's not directly from the text, but it's a great application. And that's something that I just like to call facility worship. It's something that all Christians are subject to. All believers, particularly believers in the modern era in the Western church, we are all subject to this thing called facility worship or property worship. And it kind of goes like this. Sometimes, you know, we love the church, we love Christ, we love the bride. And sometimes that love for Christ and that love for the church can get mixed up with worshiping the facilities that God has given to the church in such a way that we begin to think that the facilities are more important than the people God has given us the facilities in order to minister to. And so we can get kind of bent out of shape about the facilities or the property of the church. So here's this man, the owner of the house, whoever it may be, they're making a hole in his roof to get a lost sinner to Jesus. I don't know if he was upset about that. I don't know if he was overjoyed about that. Whatever the case, do you see the connection? Sometimes we can get so uptight in the modern church about the properties and the things and the buildings and the carpets and the chairs and the food and the rooms and everything that God has given to us to use for the kingdom, we can start to think that they're more important than the people whom God wants us to use those things to minister to. There's so many examples that we could point to. I remember our first church, there was a group of young teenage girls that started coming and attending our church. They were completely unchurched, had never been in the context of a church. And so we all can imagine those who have no church background whatsoever, when you start attending church, guess what you don't know how to do? You don't know how to act. You don't know what's expected of you. And so these girls they were coming and they were absorbing, but they also had issues that they brought with them. And I mean, they would leave like bubblegum wrappers in the seats and stuff like that, and candy wrappers in the seats. And it didn't take long before some in the church started to say, these young girls need to learn how to act. One of those girls eventually ended up stealing her camera. But that's kind of what it came to. These girls, they're not acting right in the house of the Lord. They need to respect the house of the Lord. Now, take all that within reason. Yes. When God blesses his bride with facilities, we care for them. But in no way can that compare to the people that were here to minister to. I had a pastor friend years ago when we were in Burlington. I had a pastor friend whose church was located in the lower socioeconomic side of town. And his church decided to open a gymnasium, a basketball gymnasium, to the community. A couple nights a week, it was open to the community to come and play basketball. And so kids would come and they'd play basketball. And most of them were coming just for the basketball. But they would also get other things. And they would also meet people who were part of the church. And they were attempting to build relationships and get to know people and minister the word in such ways. And it didn't take long before, guess what? A window got broken. And you can imagine what happens from there. Now, well, these people aren't caring for God's house. They're not caring for God's facilities. The sin of worshiping the property, the things, the facilities that God gives to the church to use, that's a sin that nips at the heels of the church its entire life. Just like Cain, how God says, it's at your door. In the same way, that kind of nips at the heels of the church, so that we must remind ourselves consistently, nothing can compare to the infinite worth of a soul, even one. All the property that all the churches that have ever existed, have ever owned, cannot compare to the value of one soul.